week. It's I'm going to be in the state of Connecticut, and I was going there for a men's conference, but when different people heard I was showing up, I now I'm going to be speaking at the University of Connecticut and Yale University and a few high schools, so I'm going to be there for 5 days. So appreciate your prayers next week while I'm gone. And one opportunity that could be helpful for us in the future is that C-SPAN wants to record the event at the University of Connecticut, perhaps Yale as well. So appreciate your prayers that all that would go smoothly, that there wouldn't be any weather problems back east, at least where I'm going. That would be appreciated. And also C-SPAN said that they needed good weather, too, in order to be able to get all their equipment there. So before we launch into our study, you know, I was in Houston. I got to speak to the Flight Control Center at NASA, and they asked me to give a message where it would be strictly science, but they want me to talk about the anthropic principle. As I told you before, I couldn't use the word God or even the big guy upstairs. And I couldn't use the term design, but I could use the word fine-tuning. And the message I gave there was how to put the anthropic principle to the test. And if you haven't heard that term, the anthropic principle refers to the fact that the universe appears to have all of these incredibly fine-tuned characteristics that makes life possible here on planet Earth. And it really does look like the universe has been purposely designed to make a home for us. Now, when I was at NASA, I said fine-tuned. I didn't want to use the word. But I said, you know, if there's really something to this anthropic principle, in other words, if it really is a scientific principle, that can we should be able to put it to the test. And one of the ways to put it to the test, and this is something newly developed at Reasons to Believe, is to demonstrate that the different objects which make life possible here on planet Earth are unique. That the cluster of galaxies in which we live is uniquely fine-tuned to make life possible. And we wouldn't expect there to be other clusters of galaxies that have those same characteristics. Likewise, our galaxy is unique. Our sun is unique. It's a unique star. And the planets that make up our solar system are uniquely fine-tuned to make life possible here on planet Earth. I said nothing about the Earth itself, just focused on the star, the planets that accompany the Earth, the galaxy, and the cluster of galaxies. Well, what has happened this past week is in the Astrophysical Journal and the Astronomical Journal, four papers have been published that buttress what I was able to communicate there at NASA, which is encouraging to us because one of the last things I said to the NASA astronomers there was that I would expect that there would be ongoing evidence published that indeed we are not able to find any solar twins or twins to our Milky Way galaxy or twins to Jupiter and Saturn orbiting about other stars. And this particular paper comes out from the Lowell Observatory and complements what's going on here at Mount Wilson. A lot of you might think that the Mount Wilson Observatory is just kind of a museum piece now. Well, it's not exactly true. They have found ways to make use of those telescopes up there in spite of the light that's being blasted out from the Los Angeles basin and the pollution that exists here. And so the Mount Wilson Observatory has been commissioned to study in detail what they call solar-type stars. Stars that are as close as they can find to the characteristics of the sun. And now the Lowell Observatory in Arizona has kind of joined in that mission to look at all these stars and see if they can actually find a star that's a close enough twin to our sun that it could be a candidate where a planet could orbit it with a possibility of supporting life. Now, this is the first of three papers that will be published. And this first paper kind of gets into how they have been able to develop the program to check in detail the spectral characteristics of stars that are as close to the sun as we can find. But what caught my attention is they have 20,000 observations that make up this first study. So this is the most extensive study that's been done of stars in our galaxy that are close to that of the sun. And this is kind of an initial report. Two more reports are coming up, but in this report they do make the point that they can't find any star in the entire catalog of solar-type stars that has the same sunspot cycle as our sun with the same period and the same amplitude. You say, is that important for life? Yes, it is, because of the amplitude is shorter, which is the case for the closest stars that come to the characteristics of the sun. You get a higher amplitude in the variation of the sunspot cycle, which results in much more chromospheric activity, which means you're going to get a lot more X-ray and ultraviolet radiational bursts coming out of those stars. So this is more evidence that we're not finding any stars. And the hope was that they'd find a star that was a closer twin to our sun than 18 Scorpio. 18 Scorpio is a faint star you can barely see with the naked eye in the constellation Scorpius, and that is listed as the closest twin to the sun. But as I showed here, I think I did this in the class. Didn't I actually take you through a little thing where I showed you all the stars that are like the sun? Some of you remember? Okay. I did that for the galaxy. I know I did that for sure. But I also thought I kind of gave you a little view of the planets that are closest to Jupiter and stars that are close. So I've done that? I haven't done the Jupiter thing? Okay. Sometime I did the galaxy thing. Okay. Okay, sometime in the future, because I got this all set up on a PowerPoint. It's actually what I showed at NASA. So sometime I'll actually show you that. But the interesting thing is you find lots of these so-called twins of the sun that are actually twins of one another. But nothing is a close twin to the sun. And 18 Scorpio comes the closest of any star to being like the sun, but it's got a different mass, a different luminosity, and has different chromospheric activity, sufficiently different that we know there can't be a planet going around it that could support life for any period of time or advance life at all. And so this study is more confirmation. And they were surprised that in that 20,000 observations, they found nothing better than 18 Scorpio. So 18 Scorpio still ranks as a star that's the closest to having the characteristics of the sun. So sometime in the future, I'll actually kind of show you. I've got a list here of six stars that come the closest to being like the sun. And what's interesting is they're remarkably close to one another, but all of them are distinct from the sun. So, and then there's another paper here in the Astrophysical Journal, the same issue. And it's the first time astronomers have looked at nearby stars to see if they have distant orbiting partners. Now you say, what's so important about that? Well, if our star had another star orbiting around it, say 1/100th of a light year away, that would be enough to disturb the orbits of planets like Earth and Venus and Mars that are orbiting closely around the sun. And so one of the critical requirements for life, at least advanced life, for a planetary system is that it not have any other stars that are orbiting about the star. Now, astronomers have looked for what they call close orbiting stars around nearby stars and have found quite a goodly number of them. But this is the first time anyone's looked for distant stars going around nearby stars. And this is, again, an initial study, and it's not exhaustive yet. But they've been able to document that a minimum of 10% of the stars in the neighborhood of the sun have distant orbiting partner stars. And what really surprised them, the expectation was that these distant orbiting stars would be relatively small stars. They're quite faint, but they're not small stars. They all have more than a tenth the mass of our star, the sun, typically a quarter to half the mass of our star, the sun. And the bigger the mass, the bigger the disturbance that star will bring to the planets in that system. And so this is additional evidence that indeed our sun seems to have unique properties. And now you say, well, how distant are we talking about? Well, we're talking between 90 and 900 billion miles from the star. And if you want to put that in some kind of context, Neptune is 4 billion miles from our star, the sun. So these are much more massive objects, much more massive than Jupiter. To give you an idea, Jupiter comes in at 0.1% the mass of the Sun. And so these are much bigger bodies that are orbiting about these systems. So, and it shows us that bachelor stars are really quite rare in our galaxy. And the more we seem to study the stars in our galaxy, the more we find being attached. So our star is a single star, and not too many stars are single stars. And then there's two papers that have been published, which have generated quite a bit of enthusiasm in the press about the fact that they are now finding planetary systems with four planets or more. And they said, finally, we're finding solar system analogs. And this is giving a lot of enthusiasm to the idea that there might be planetary systems out there that could harbor a planet like Earth with life on it. But if you read these papers carefully, this one system they've now found that's got four planets orbiting about it, and they said just like our planetary system has four gas giants, this system has four gas giants. But they're nothing like the gas giants in our solar system. It is true that there are four. But if you look at the four, one has a period of 9 days, which is what we call a hot Jupiter. And actually, it's not that massive a planet. It's more accurate to call it a hot Neptune. And if it's orbiting just 9 days, that means it's very close to the star. Then there's another one that orbits at 307 days from its star, which means it's orbiting a little bit closer to the star than the Earth does to our own Sun. And there's one at 630 days, which is a little bit more than the orbital period of Mars. And then the fourth one's at 2,500 days, which is a little bit less than the orbital period of Jupiter. However, because these gas giants are bigger, the three of them are bigger than Jupiter. One is quite a bit smaller, Neptune size, but they're all orbiting too close to their stars in order for life to be possible in that system. I mean, just to review for you, if you have a planet any closer to the star than Jupiter would be, then the gravity of that planet would be sufficient to disturb the orbit of a planet like Earth, at least disturb it enough that long-term life would not be possible. And if you make it a little bit more massive, the same thing happens. And if you don't make it massive enough, the planet can't protect the life support planet from comet and asteroid collisions. And likewise, if you're to make Jupiter a little less massive or a little farther away, then it's not an adequate protector. In fact, to really give the planet Earth the possibility of long-term life, you really do need four gas giants. You need the biggest and most massive one to be closest to the Sun, the second biggest, most massive one to be the second farthest or second closest to the Sun, and you want two small ones that are quite a good distance out. It really is critical that you've got a Jupiter, a Saturn, a Uranus, and a Neptune with the masses we see in our solar system, with the distances we see with respect to their star. The other requirement is they all have to have very circular orbits. If the orbits are elliptical or egg-shaped, then that means the planet will come a little too close to the star at certain points in its orbit and begin to disturb the orbital paths of the small rocky planets that are in close. So it is true, they've now found a system that's got four gas giants in it. However, the gas giants have the wrong mass, the wrong distance, and the wrong shape of the orbit to enable a planet like Earth to be possible. And likewise, there's another study that where they're showing additional stars. What's happening is that astronomers are looking at all the planetary systems that they have found, where they have found a gas giant orbiting it. And now that they've got a few more years of observations, they can see certain anomalies in the radio velocity profiles of these stars that tells them there must be a second planet, a third planet, or a fourth planet orbiting them. The initial study would simply pick up the biggest and closest planet orbiting that star, but now that we've got 15, pick up the gravitational influence of the smaller planets that are orbiting about them. And so they are findable planet systems, but it's still true. We're finding no solar system analogs. Yes. It won't form that close. In order for a gas giant planet to form, it must form past what's called the snow line. So, for example, in our solar system, there's a certain distance from the star, from our sun, where water will be frozen. Closer than that, it will be in gas form. And for a gas giant planet to form, it's got to be farther away from the star than what's called the snow line. Now then, how do you explain all these gas giants being so close? Well, if they form relatively quickly, and most of them do, that means by the time that they have reached their planet formation stage, there's still gas and dust remaining in the pre-stellar disk, and the gas giant will interact with that dust, and the interaction with that dust means it drifts in towards its star, and it'll keep drifting until the dust is gone. Now, you say, why didn't that happen to Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune? Actually, it did. They did drift in a little bit. But because of the way the gas and dust in the solar, pre-solar nebula formed into planets, that gas and dust got exhausted almost at the same time that the planets had formed, and therefore the gas giants did not drift in too much. The other factor for our solar system is it was blessed with two asteroid belts. Mostly familiar with the asteroid belt between Jupiter and Mars, there's another one beyond the orbit of Neptune. However, when our solar system was young, that Kuiper belt of asteroids and comets was actually situated roughly where Saturn is right now. And so the interaction of the early formed gas giants with the dust causes them to move in. However, their interaction with asteroids and comets causes them to move out. And so the actual history of our solar system is the gas giants moving in slightly, then the gas and dust being exhausted, so they stop drifting inward, and then they begin to interact with these comets and asteroids in the Kuiper belt and drift outward. And so that explains why they're there right now, but it also explains when we're looking at other planetary systems which form more typically, which means that the gas and dust remains for a significant period of time, we see that almost all of these extraplanetary systems have what we call hot Jupiters, where the Jupiter-sized planet has drifted significantly towards its star. Well, the drift of a gas giant towards its star, as many astronomers have pointed out, actually disrupts the formation of rocky planets, as we're not going to find very many rocky planets, period, orbiting closely around their stars, because this drift mechanism actually prevents those. And if they do form, the movement of the gas giant inward will disrupt the orbit, make the orbit either chaotic or certainly disturb it from that orbit that it needs where life would be permanently sustainable. So even though we found over 220 planets now orbiting other stars, none of those planets have the characteristics which would make possible the existence of a life support planet in that system. Anyways, more evidence that the more we learn about stars and planets in our galaxy, the more evidence we're finding for the supernatural design of our solar system for the benefit of life. So one of the that was the final statement I said at NASA. I said, you know, all you guys have got to do is wait 30 days or 90 days or a year, and you will have more evidence if indeed this anthropic principle has Christian implications. Yes. We know a number of them must smash into their stars, because what we're noticing is that a number of stars that do have planets orbiting about them are what we call super metal rich, which means that the star is showing a much more abundance of metals than what our star, the Sun, shows. And they've been trying to figure out, because our star is really quite metal rich, how do you explain these other stars being significantly more metal rich than our star? Well, the answer that most astronomers think is right is what they call self-pollution. That the metals preferentially will be in the disk about the star as opposed to the star, and if planets form there and if those planets get sucked into the star, that could explain why the star has an extra abundance of metals. You know, if it's absorbed 3 or 4 or 5 Jupiters, then that would explain it quite nicely. So they do crash. However, when the system runs out of gas and dust, the planet stops its inward movement. And so if the gas and dust is gone, it will maintain a stable orbit about the star, even though it's, say, only 1 million miles away from the star. It's still stable. But if it doesn't run out of gas and dust, it goes all the way under the star. And that probably happens in maybe 30-40% of the cases. Yes. Okay, 99.73% of the universe is stuff that does not emit any light at all. Only 0.27% would be what we would call stars, planets, or the remnants of stars and planets. So black holes, white dwarfs, brown dwarfs, planets, stars, whether they're still burning or not burning, only make up 0.27% of all the stuff of the universe. The dark stuff makes up 99.73%. But it takes three forms. You've got dark energy, which makes up about 73%. You've got exotic dark matter, which makes up about 22 or 23%. And the 4% you've been hearing about is what they call ordinary dark matter. So 4.2% is ordinary matter that's dark, and 0.27% is ordinary matter that you can either see light coming out of it, or you can recognize that it was an object that was once, revealing some kind of light. 73% is dark energy. Okay. Yes. It's the percentage of the total density of the universe. So think of the stuff of the universe. And the difficulty here is that energy is technically stuff. You can convert matter into energy and vice versa. So energy is, and energy actually exerts a density factor on the universe. Well, none of it's nothing. I mean, I remember several years ago they asked me to take the morning services here in the church, and they said, well, how about if you let me give a sermon on nothing? And so I talked about what the Bible means by nothing and what scientists mean by nothing. And the whole point here is when, you know, astronomers talk about the universe being created out of nothing, or, you know, energy and matter coming out of nothing, you have to remember they got 5 different definitions of nothing. And so when you hear all these philosophical debates about nothing, it's not really nothing. It really is something. So, well, for example, there are skeptics of Big Bang cosmology, both atheists and young Earth creationists, who say, you know, since we can't see this dark energy, maybe the Big Bang model is wrong. Maybe there was no creation of the universe. Maybe the universe really isn't 14 billion years old. However, it's a misnomer to say that we can't see the dark energy. Now, I just gave you some rather accurate percentages for 3 different kinds of dark stuff. How could I give you those accurate percentages if we couldn't detect that stuff? Now, it is true we can't see light coming out of that material, but we can detect it. And we can detect it because this dark stuff has a gravitational influence. Or in the case of dark energy, it is something that mimics anti-gravity. And so it really does have an effect on the dynamics of the universe. And that's basically how astronomers detect this stuff. They look for dynamical impact. And so we look at our own fact. I don't have the paper here. It's in my briefcase there. It's a brand new paper published where they've been able to map all the exotic dark stuff in our galaxy and have actually determined there must be at least 10,000 subhalos of dark, exotic dark matter in our galaxy that's embedded in a giant kind of continuous uniform superhalo. Now, you say, how can they come up with that kind of detail for something you can't even see any light? They look for the gravitational signature of the exotic dark matter. So whether the matter is ordinary, and when I mean by ordinary matter, I mean matter that we're kind of used to, matter that's composed of protons, neutrons, and electrons, the stuff you studied in your elementary physics class. That's what we call ordinary matter. And the stuff that we can see easily would be stars. The stuff we can't see would be things like pebbles and rocks and dust and black holes. If they're mini black holes, they're going to be difficult to detect. On the other hand, you can look at the gravitational influence of a whole bunch of pebbles. I mean, if you've got several trillion pebbles residing in a little portion of our galaxy, it's going to exert a gravitational pull on objects you can see, like the stars. And so that's what astronomers do, is they map the galaxies in our universe, the stars in our Milky Way galaxy, and they look for the dynamical disturbances, the push and pull on these objects that must be coming from hidden dark sources. Now, what's interesting is that the exotic stuff will behave differently than the ordinary stuff. You say, what's the exotic stuff? The exotic matter is particles that have the property that they don't interact well with radiation. Protons, neutrons, and electrons powerfully interact with photons. The exotic stuff does not interact with the photons, or if it does interact, it interacts in a very weak fashion. And if you've been watching Discovery or PBS, they refer to this stuff as WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. And so protons, neutrons, and electrons would be strongly interacting massive particles. I guess we should call them SIMPs. Whereas the exotic stuff we call WIMPs. And I think I've told this joke before, is that astronomers were really embarrassed when they came up with the word quasar, and then some electronics company actually took that name and put it on their TV set. And so they said, we're not going to let this happen again. They took a trademark out of the term WIMP, just to make sure that no one out there ever manufactures a product and calls it a WIMP. So who's going to buy something called a WIMP? And just to show you how naive they are, we have another group of objects that we call machos. And they made no attempt to trademark machos. I mean, they should have trademarked that and left the WIMPs alone. But so you can still take the name macho and attach that to your automobile, your refrigerator, or your TV set. So, that's how we can demonstrate that the universe indeed has all this stuff. And the amazing thing is we now have the technology where we can measure the quantity of this stuff down to about a percent precision. Yeah, question? Neutrinos have now been determined, active neutrinos, to have a relatively low mass. And so the physics community now says certainly they make up a portion of the exotic matter, but probably just a tiny portion of the exotic matter. If you wait a couple of months, maybe less than a couple of months, I'm putting out an article on sterile neutrinos in the next issue of Connections, our magazine from Reasons to Believe. And sterile neutrinos, unlike active neutrinos, could actually have quite a bit of mass. And some astronomers actually think that the 22% of the total stuff of the universe is made up of sterile neutrinos. I'm personally skeptical. I think they might make up 2 to 5%, but not 22%, and maybe as little as 1%. So we're looking at other particles to make up the majority of this exotic matter. The favorite candidate amongst astronomers, well, two candidates that they really like, axions and neutrinos. Axions are a little bit ahead of the pack. There's actually some good evidence in the from the way quasars react that axions may indeed be the dominant particle making up exotic matter. For what it's worth, there are 38 candidates to make up that exotic matter. But we're not talking clumps. We're talking particles. So thinly distributed particles. But these particles will clump into halos and subhalos rather effectively. Yeah. The exotic matter would not have any magnetic properties, or if it has magnetic properties, they're weak. Again, it's weakly interacting mass of particles, and so its capacity to interact with electromagnetic radiation would be extraordinarily weak. You say, well, how weak do you mean? Well, it's weak enough that when they make neutrino detectors, they point them down into the Earth. And like, for example, the sun, we know, pours out huge quantities of neutrinos. But because they so weakly interact with matter, we kind of need the 8,000-mile diameter of the Earth and all the matter that's in there to provide enough of an absorber that we can detect a few of the ones that actually do interact. And so it's kind of interesting. Other telescopes point straight up to the sky. These are designed to go right through the Earth because the neutrinos literally, you know, by far the majority of them go through the entire Earth without hitting anything or interacting with anything. Right. Well, the blackness you see in these photographs are ordinary dark matter. That's ordinary dark, because what you're seeing there is dust that's blocking out the light of stars behind it. That's predominantly all the dark lanes. You see that dark lane in there? That's dust. So it's just little tiny particles about a thousandth of a millimeter across that block out light. Now, it can only block out light for so much. You notice that some of that darkness there actually has a bit of a color to it. And what happens is that dust will absorb light for so long, and then it heats up and begins to emit light. And so dust can only absorb light for so long before it re-emits it. Okay, the light you see in those galaxies is predominantly from stars. And the dark stuff would be the dust or the lack of matter. I mean, between the spiral arms, you just don't have that much matter. And so that's why it would look dark. But the exotic dark matter wouldn't leave any visible signature on these photographs at all. The only way to detect them is by looking at the movements of the stars in the galaxy or the movement of the galaxy relative to other galaxies. And somebody here was asking a question about halos. Okay, you think of our Milky Way galaxy and the ordinary matter, and keep in mind the ordinary matter we don't see is about 20 times as abundant as the matter, ordinary matter we do see. So there's 20 times as much ordinary dark matter as there is matter that emits light. And this ordinary dark matter is distributed mostly as a halo around our Milky Way galaxy. You say, how did it get there? Well, when our galaxy was very young, it was forming really big stars. And these big stars would burn up quickly, like in about a million years. And when they were done, they would blow their star to smithereens and blow the star with such extraordinary force. And incidentally, you get that extraordinary force because of the neutrinos. Neutrinos play a critical role in making sure that when a star explodes, the stuff inside gets blasted out to great distances. The bigger the star, the bigger the explosion. And when our galaxy is young, the explosions are so incredibly powerful, it blows out most of the gas and dust in that galaxy outside the galaxy. And so in a huge halo around our galaxy is this blown out material from the first supernova in our galaxy. You say, how big are we talking? The diameter of the halo is about 10 times the size of the visible galaxy. So when you look at our galaxy, it's about 100,000 light years across. The ordinary dark matter halo is about 1 million light years in diameter, about that. And this brand new discovery is they're actually seeing structure in that halo. So it's not just a uniform halo like astronomers thought it was 6 months ago. We now recognize that this halo about our Milky Way galaxy is broken up into a lot of substructure. A lot of mini halos are embedded in that maxi halo. But then beyond that halo is an even bigger halo made up of exotic matter. And you say, what are the dimensions? Well, it's about 10 times as big as the ordinary matter or ordinary dark matter halo. So you've got this enormous halo of exotic matter that embeds the smaller halo of ordinary dark matter that embeds our galaxy. And then around our cluster of galaxies is a really big exotic matter halo. You say, what has all this got to do with anything we're talking about here in the class? What it's got to do with what we're talking about in the class is that this has been a brand new source of proof that indeed the universe has been extraordinarily designed for the benefit of life. Because the geometry of all these halos must be extraordinarily fixed or fine-tuned in order to make sure that the galaxy has the right dynamics to enable life to exist in that galaxy. If all the matter was concentrated, then their galaxy would be gobbled up by a gigantic black hole. And you don't want that. I mean, we do have a big black hole in the center of our galaxy, but it only is about 3 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. If there was a few billion times the mass of our star, the Sun, then there'd be no life possible in our galaxy. And thanks to the distribution of these dark matter halos, how much mass is in the halos and how big the halos are and the shape of the halos, we get to have a galaxy that has just the right spiral dynamics and just the right mass distribution to make possible a planetary system orbiting about that galaxy so life would be possible. It's the newest evidence we've found in astronomy for the supernatural design of the universe for the benefit of life. And here's a teaser. It was anticipated in the book of Job, chapter 38, verses 19 and 20. You can read those two verses. That's where God asked the five assembled men there, probably the most intelligent and best educated men on the planet at the time, Job and his four friends. He asked them about cosmic darkness, and they haven't got a clue. Today, after 3,500 years, we now have a clue. I'll give you a tip about Job 38. Job 38, God asks these five best-educated men on the planet all kinds of science questions that they can't answer. You know, he asks them 59 questions, and the score they get is 0 out of 59. But I believe every one of those 59 questions is a prediction of a future scientific discovery. A future scientific discovery that will give us evidence for God's miraculous supernatural handiwork for the benefit of humanity. That's the context of Job 38 and 39, how God creates to bless the human species. And so the questions he asks are all in the context of things he's done to supernaturally bless the human species. Now, if you want to ask me how well we're doing today, out of those 59 questions, when I taught on this in the class a year ago, I told you we could answer 9 of the questions. Today, because of the darkness thing, we can answer 10. But, you know, and when I taught at the university level, if one of my students got 10 out of 59, it was not considered a passing grade. So we got a ways to go yet. But I look at that as kind of a list of things that God has given us scientists to study to find his handiwork. So we got a lot more we can do. But what amazes me, about the 10 that we can answer, the darkness stuff is where we get our most spectacular evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design. Of the 10, that's the best. And it's something that was only firmly nailed down just 6 months ago. Okay, Well, there's a whole lot there that have to do with this controversy over global warming. I mean, if you read the chapter, so maybe this global warming political brouhaha that's going on will actually stimulate some scientific research that could expose a few more of the unanswered questions in Job 38. We'll see. I mean, there's always got to be a benefit to these political debates, right? I mean, maybe not, but... Don't want to answer that one. All right. Yeah, go ahead, Jackie. We will update it when we think the evidence justifies an update. So, but yeah, that was the whole reason for writing that article, is to make the point, you know, we're just scratching this problem. It's like the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, certainly the inventor of the Internet is mistaken when he thinks it's just one issue that affects, you know, global climate. There are many issues. And we need to really understand a lot more than we understand. And, you know, my whole political message here is, if you don't understand the problem, then you're likely to make a political mistake in trying to legislate a solution to the problem. And thanks, Jackie, for sending me that newspaper article. She gave me a newspaper article this morning written by, well, it's an interview of an astronomer who's come up with a solution to global warming. You know what his solution is? To put up a bunch of the equivalent of paper plates into orbit between us and the sun to block out the light of the sun, kind of like a solar umbrella out there. The one thing that concerns me about that is that so much that affects the climate of planet Earth is cyclical. And so you could actually put something up there to block out the light of the sun, then a few years later regret that you've done it. Yeah, we need a garbage truck to go up there and pick them all up, and we don't need them anymore. But I don't think it's going to happen because, you know, it'd be rather expensive to get it up there. And it's not just enough to put it in orbit about the Earth. You've got to put it in an orbit that's sufficiently distant that these paper plates or shields or umbrellas or whatever you want to call them will always remain between you and the sun. And that's a fairly expensive orbital achievement, and you're going to have to put up more than a half dozen paper plates, obviously. You're going to have to put up several million of them to make this work. But as I said, what are you going to do when the cycles change and you want to remove them? Then you want to maybe put up reflectors to put more light coming in. All of this, I think, is symptomatic that we in the 21st century believe that we have a right to a perfect climate all the time. And we don't. Planet Earth has never had as benign a climate as it does right now for global human civilization. And we're mistaken if we think that the conditions we have today we can enjoy forever. We need to recognize that God has placed us here just the right time, at the perfect time, in order to develop global high technology civilization, and to recognize that the purpose for which he's placed us here is a short-term purpose. God never intended that we remain here for a billion years. As soon as we finish our job, he's going to move us on from this universe to the next one. He's got a new creation plan for us. I mean, I think this is the battle we're facing at Reasons to Believe, is that you're facing this naturalistic paradigm which thinks that, you know, this whole universe is here for us. In one sense, that's true, but it's not here for us to keep forever. And there are certain things that are bound to happen that are guaranteed, no matter how many pie plates we put up there, that are going to make human life impossible here in the relatively near future. Yes, Steve. Why is it important to keep track of? Well, dark energy was discovered by astronomers making very careful measurements of the expansion of the universe throughout cosmic history. Now, when I was a graduate student, the assumption was that that would be a linear relationship. We now can see that it's not linear. It's close to linear, but it's not perfectly linear. And because it's not perfectly linear, that means there's at least two factors governing the dynamics of the universe. Now, one that Einstein had recognized right away was gravity, that the universe has mass. And because it has mass, that mass will act as a brake on the expansion of the universe. Dark energy is an accelerant. It accelerates the expansion of the universe. And this recognition that the universe is 73% dark energy and only 27% matter is the fact that we can measure that there's been significant speeding up of the expansion of the universe over the past 5.5 billion years. And in order to account for that much speeding up, dark energy indeed must make up 73%. Now, there's more to the story. In order to have the universe expand at exactly the right rate throughout cosmic history, so that you'll get a planet like Earth forming at the right time in cosmic history for life to be possible, in other words, forming soon enough that you don't run out of uranium and thorium. You don't want to run out of uranium and thorium because that's what drives the building of the continental plates and the continents. In order to get it to happen at the right time, you have to fine-tune the constant that governs dark energy to better than 1 part in 10 to the 120th. And it ranks today as the most spectacular evidence we have for the supernatural design of the universe for the benefit of the human species. There is no better evidence scientifically for the supernatural design of the universe by a creator beyond space and time than the dark energy fine-tuning. By the way, the second best evidence we have is the fine-tuning on the exotic dark matter. So in that sense, darkness is really important to establishing the Christian faith. These are the two places in science where we get our best evidence for supernatural design. Now, is that going to continue? It wouldn't at all surprise me if we see that there are discoveries of additional factors in physics and certainly in biology where the fine-tuning is greater and more spectacular than what we find in dark energy. But right now, dark energy is the king of the hill. That's the best evidence we have, and it's rigorous evidence. It was such powerful evidence that three atheist physicists, and I've got the paper at home, said dark energy must be wrong. Because if dark energy is right, then there's got to be paper never got it into the peer-reviewed literature. It did get posted in several different versions on the Los Alamos website of preprints for physics papers, but it never got into the peer-reviewed literature because by the time it went through the peer review process, astronomers had came up with 9 independent observational proofs that dark energy is real. Now, the problem there is if dark energy is real, then we really are stuck with a supernatural agent performing miracles for reasons of his own. And as the paper points out, it must be a supernatural agent that operates beyond space and time. Well, the gods of the different religions of the world, it's the God of the Bible that fits that description, not the gods of the Eastern religions. Steve, you got another point? Yeah, it is stuff in our living room that we can't feel or touch or see or taste, but we know it's there. And we know it's there because of the dynamical effect it has on the universe. So it's well known, well established. As I said, we have 9 different observational proofs that this thing really does exist, and it's a dominant component of the universe. So if you were to ask me, what it makes up most of the stuff of the universe, it's dark energy. You know, I find it interesting that these three atheists, before dark energy became conclusively proven, said, if this stuff exists, and we really are stuck with a supernatural agent beyond space and time, performing miracles for reasons of his own. And every month that goes by, we come up with more evidence for this dark energy. Okay, we got a one more question, then we want to get into our lesson. All right. That's right. So in that sense, that's hidden stuff in your living room. So you've never seen electricity, but several of us have probably felt it once or twice. So, yeah, always wear shoes when you're changing a light bulb, okay? All right. Gospel according to David. This is where we got going last week. In Psalm 19, we have this statement. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. That's how King David starts off Psalm 19. But look at how he ends Psalm 19. As you get to the end of Psalm 19, he makes the following statement. Here we go. He says, who can forgive my errors? He says, who can discern my errors? Who can forgive my hidden faults? Who can keep your servant from willful sins that they may not rule over me? In other words, he's making reference to the fact that there's a God out there that actually has the power not only to discern every mistake we make, every error we commit, every sin we commit, but has the capacity to forgive all of these things that we may not be aware of. And you know, that's the whole thing that King David recognized. He says, you know, I'm aware of some of my sins, but the vast majority of my sins are simply not in my knowledge. But God knows them all. And this is something he repeatedly brought up, is that we human beings are only aware of a tiny fraction of the offenses we commit against one another and we commit against our Savior. But he says he keeps a list. He knows every single one. None of them passes by his attention, but he's also a God who's capable of forgiving. And so what we're looking at here is how King David was able to discern through what he had received from Moses, through what he had received was a relationship with the Lord, the Holy Spirit working within him, and what he was able to discern through the record of nature, starting as a shepherd boy and then on to his role as a king over the whole nation of Israel. But he starts the psalm off by saying, obviously, there's got to be a creator. And what we're kind of doing here is mirroring what Job and Elihu did in their book. And in their book, they didn't have the revelation of Moses. They didn't have any written scripture. But they did have the record of nature, and they had the Holy Spirit working within them. King David has considerably more. But not nearly as much as what we have. He did not see the work of the Savior. He did not have the revelation of the New Testament authors, or for that matter, any of the major prophets. He was writing 3,000 years ago, and at that time, the Bible consisted of just the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. So that's what he was working with in terms of written revelation. The rest of it, the other 61 books of the Bible, were not yet available. Although some of the historical books, probably like Judges and Joshua, were available at that time, or at least being put together. But he begins his declaration of the basics of the gospel with the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands, their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. Now, as I mentioned last week, what I've done is to go through every one of King David's Psalms. And that's about half of all the Psalms in the Bible. And interestingly, this is the only statement you find in all of David's writings about, you know, the point that there's got to be a creator. His basic assumption is this is so obvious that everybody accepts this. I mean, there are no atheists. I mean, you've got to accept the fact that there's a creator. And he immediately jumps into what the record of nature reveals about the characteristics of the Creator. So he says, there must be a Creator. If you don't believe it, just look up at the heavens, look at the earth, and you'll see God speaking through the heavens and the earth, telling you that he is there. And what is he telling you? he is telling you that he is extremely powerful and very wise. And Psalm 8, the first of King David's Psalms, or the second, pardon me, he also wrote Psalm 2. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. And so he's making the point here, as we look at the earth and look at the heavens, we see that God is majestic, very powerful, and incredibly wise in the way he's put it all together for our benefit. Psalm 33, which is a creation psalm we're going to look at after we finish Psalm 19. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, their starry hosts by the breath of his mouth. So when you look up at the stars and the galaxies, every one of them were put into place, every individual star, by the word of the Lord and by the breath of his mouth. He speaks and we have things being created. The plans of the Lord stand firm. A couple of verses later, in Psalm 33, King David says, the plans of the Lord stand firm forever, the purposes of his heart through all generations. Now, a word of caution here. This verse has been taken out of context by some Christian interpreters of creation theology, using this verse to claim that the universe is going to last forever and ever. And we need to recognize that only in the Greek language, of the biblical languages, is there a word that means all eternity. The word in the Hebrew can mean all of eternity, or it can mean a very, very long period of time. And so the same word is translated forever here is also used of the Aaronic priesthood, that it would last, quote, forever, which means it would last for dozens of generations, not necessarily for all eternity. And so it doesn't mean that when God creates the universe is going to last for all eternity. But it does mean that God's plans, his plans for our future, his plans for what he's going to do with the universe, what he's going to do with humanity, his purposes, that is eternal. That will not be shaken. It won't be disturbed. There aren't things that we human beings can do that would force God to change his plan or his purposes. Believe it or not, there are powerful theologians in the evangelical church today who are claiming through what's called open theism that the human activity within the church and outside the church can change God's plans and God's purposes. But 3,000 years ago, King David said that's not the case. So if you want to, this is a nice verse you can use against the open theism that's being preached in many churches today. Yes. Right. Well, what I did say is it could mean all of eternity. It's just that not every instant where that Hebrew word shows up should we insist that it be translated for all of eternity. Now, in the New Testament, when you see it translated forever, you can appreciate that that indeed means for all of eternity. In the Hebrew, it could be either way. And it's symptomatic of the fact that in biblical Hebrew, you've only got 3,000 words total that are not proper nouns. And so virtually every Hebrew word has multiple literal definitions. Just like the Hebrew word for day has four different definitions, in this case, the Hebrew word for forever has got two different definitions. So you look at the context to see which one it is. So I think you're quite correct to claim that in Psalm 23, it really does mean for all of eternity. For one thing, they're talking about death and moving on to the next life. And so your existence here on earth is not eternal. The earth is not eternal. The universe is not eternal. However, when you cross that threshold to be with the Lord as a redeemed human being, that is for all of eternity. Okay. I think that's one reason why God gave us a New Testament. Because in the New Testament, you got a different language, different dictionary, and therefore we can say things in a manner that's not possible in the Old Testament. On the other hand, Greek has got weaknesses that Hebrew overcomes. If you read the New Testament, it's hard to get the emotional impact that you can get with the Old Testament. The Hebrew language is a very good language for communicating different emotional nuances, which, by the way, some translations do a terrible job of translating. New American Standard, in my opinion, does about the worst job of trying to get the emotional nuance out of the original. Other translations do a much better job. But again, New American Standard does a great job on getting the doctrinal accuracy of things like the Trinity. Does a very good job on that. But in order to do such a good job, it sacrifices some of the emotional content. So if you want to read King David's Psalms and get the full emotional power of it, I would pick up a different translation besides the New American Standard. His Psalms don't have nearly the emotional impact in that translation. I think you'll be able to see a little bit. This is the New International Version I'm using here, which also isn't the best translation for picking up the emotion, but it is better, in my opinion, than the New American Standard. Okay, the Creator is powerful and wise. King David's got more to say about this topic. Psalm 40, verse 5, "Many, O Lord, are the wonders you have done. For do I speak and tell of them, they would be too many to declare." As I mentioned last week, what he's really saying here is that for every individual human being, God has performed so many miracles on your behalf, you can't record them all. So everyone, it's not like God takes favorites. Someone says, "Oh, well, God performed a whole bunch of miracles for King David." He did. And a lot of them are recorded here in the Bible. Literally dozens of miracles, outstanding miracles God performed on behalf of King David. But King David's point here is he's not unique. God does this for every human being. What was different about King David is I think he was more spiritually aware of God's miracles being performed on his behalf. The rest of us, not having the spiritual maturity of the King David or the sensitivity of the King David, God performs a bunch of miracles and we walk around as if nothing happened, or that we're the ones that are responsible for all of our good fortune. As I mentioned last week on this, it really is a miracle any of us makes it out of our teenage years. And you think of all the foolish things you did back then. At least I can think of a bunch. But the theme that King David really spends a lot of time on is this point about the Creator being. And for what it's worth, what I'm giving you here, I think, is exhaustive. I've gone through all of his Psalms and pulled out everything he says about these 7 points of the gospel. But he says the most about this point. This seemed to be the passion of King David, was to get across to the Israelites and the pagans around them that God not only exists, this God is loving in a way that you can't even imagine. And here's this one in Psalm 23. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul." And if you read the rest of the psalm, he's talking about death. And it's interesting how he says, "I'm heading towards death. My body is decaying. It's breaking down. I lack nothing." And that's the attitude we should have about getting old, right? Okay? A few of you are like me. You're beginning to get into your advanced years. And we need to look at our advanced years in that context. Even though everything's breaking apart and we've got pain like we've never had before, I lack nothing. And that God is getting everything ready for me to go through the green pastures into the threshold of death and take me beside those quiet waters and restore my soul. That was the wonderful thing about watching both of my parents pass on, is I could see that there was a peace and a quietness as they approached the gates of death. And that's what King David's talking about here. Of course, it's only true for believers. Unbelievers, it's a very different story. Okay. "All the ways of the Lord are loving and faithful." All the ways, not just some of the ways. And again, we all complain about the consequences of the second law of thermodynamics, or what's more affectionately known as Murphy's Law. But we need to appreciate even those ways are loving and faithful. And there's something loving and faithful about all the traumas that we have. By the way, I'm kind of on a campaign of reasons to believe to see what we can do to get rid of this phrase that we call natural evil. I don't like it, but it's been embedded in theology for 2,000 years. That there is evil we get from people like Hitler and, well, there's a few other people I can think of. I have a thing with names. So, anyway, Stalin, Hitler, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, I mean, just to name a few from the 20th century. And certainly we all recognize that that is evil. There's evil in the human heart. But I am disturbed that there's this attempt in modern theology to ascribe evil to hurricanes, earthquakes, sandstorms, rainstorms, droughts, you know, buildings falling down and killing people. I don't like to call that natural evil. I just see that as the natural outcome of the laws of physics, that the laws of physics were created in order to be a demonstration of God's love towards us. And, you know, Jesus was the one who made the point, well, you know, these laws are here for your benefit. Without the laws that would bring about these disasters, you wouldn't be able to eat. You wouldn't be able to work. You wouldn't be able to think. You wouldn't be able to enjoy life. And we need to recognize that God has designed the second law of thermodynamics, complete with all the disasters that it brings about, in order to make our life here on planet Earth as pleasant as possible, given the fact that we're struggling to deal with real evil, not just natural evil, and that God's on a mission to conquer and remove that evil. And the laws of physics he chose plays a critical role in bringing about a speedy conquest and removal of that evil. In that context, Jesus said, don't build your house upon the sand, build it upon the rock. Know that these things will happen. The wind will blow, the rain will fall, the droughts will come, the earthquakes will shake the earth. And therefore, be wise in how you structure your life so that you will not suffer the consequences of these laws of physics. But please, if you have any respect for me, don't call this evil. It's not evil. This is all good. And I don't know what I'm going to do or what we can do at Reasons to Believe to get this kind of terminology out of the church. And I mentioned that because when Fuzz and I were involved in this debate with the atheists at Texas A&M, that was their whole argument against the God of the Bible. If there is a God out there that is loving and all-powerful, why do these things happen to people? Well, one answer is they happen because we don't build our house upon the rock. The other reason is they happen because if it wasn't for those laws of thermodynamics and gravity and electromagnetism, we'd be in far worse shape than we are right now. And you know, one of the answers they gave is, think about a little child. What I mean is one is just a few months old learning how to walk. I don't know what it was like with your children, but my boys didn't believe that the law of gravity would hurt them. It took some time for them to realize that the law of gravity can do them significant damage. But I think it went on into their teenage years before they really began to appreciate that. And therefore, they had to adjust their behavior in order to avoid those consequences. So, you know, a lot of people thought, particularly my younger son, that we were being abusive towards him because of all the bruises he had on him. But for him, he was a skeptic concerning the law of gravity. His brother learned rather quickly, but he was a skeptic. Yes. Oh, my health? Well, I'm doing great. Yeah. Well, for those of you who hadn't heard, about 6 months ago, I had chest pains that I experienced on my, I run, back then I was running three times a week. And during my runs, I felt these pains, and they went in, gave me a stress test, and they said, you passed, don't worry about it. It's got to be just muscle or skeletal, whatever. Pains persisted. I came back from speaking in Toronto and said, the pain's getting really bad now. And then they gave me an angiogram and said, amazing, you got a blockage there. But it was only one blockage. And they were going to fix it with a stent, which means I could walk out 10 minutes later. But it turns out the blockage was right at the entrance of the main artery to the heart, which meant that it was risk of that breaking and giving me a serious heart attack. So 10 hours later, I was under the knife. And they did a bypass, but it was a single bypass. And to this day, my surgeons and my doctors can't figure out why I ever had the blockage. And their current thinking is that it's not cholesterol, it's something else, because my cholesterol is really low. There's no history in my family. They said, what they told me all my years is you're zero risk for any heart problems, because you have no risk factors at all. My diet was good, exercise was good, no family history. Cholesterol was down around 110, and they said, you can't be having any problems. However, I've read the medical textbooks on it. People in my category that are rated as having zero risk, one out of 100,000 has the same problems I have, and they still don't know why. But right now, they're treating me to try to get metals. They think it might be a metal deposit. So I was taking calcium before this operation. I'm no longer taking any calcium. And I've gone through my diet and tried to figure out how can I get rid of all these heavy metals. So that's what I'm doing. And the doctor told me to run every day, so I run every day. So I run about 3 to 4 miles every morning. So, and I'm running at a better pace than I did before the operation. But I am 5 pounds lighter. I don't know if you noticed, but I'm not as heavy as I was before the operation. Yes. For the uninstructed, what is the second law of thermodynamics? That's the law that says things will get messier all by themselves. Things, I'll give you the biblical perspective. Romans 8 puts it this way. That God has built this law of decay. And the law of decay rules the entire universe. No matter where you go in the universe, you're going to find the law of decay. And that law of decay simply states that left to themselves, things will decay. So if you tidy up your closet, you can't just close the door and expect it to stay tidy. It will get messy all by itself. Dust will accumulate and things will fall down and chaos will build up over time. Now, it gets sped up a lot if you let your kids go into the closet. But even if you leave the door locked, it will get messy all by itself because of this law of decay. So, but because of that law of decay, we can process food and get energy from our food and do work. Because of that law of decay, we can think and build up knowledge. So the law of decay is not fundamentally evil. But there are many theologians I do battle with today who look at the second law of thermodynamics as being a natural evil that God imposed upon us. Whereas a scientist, I look at this and say, this is not a natural evil. It's a blessing that God has given us. If there was no second law, there'd be no possibility for physical life. If there was no second law, we wouldn't get any heat from the sun. And things would be much worse if that law were ever to reverse. By the way, if the second law of thermodynamics ever reverses, we're all dead. So thank God for the second law. But because of that second law, we fall down and hurt ourselves. We have things like hurricanes and earthquakes and natural disasters. Yes. No, my doctor has taken... Yeah, they had all this stuff in the hospital that I was supposed to do. And by the time, I was only in the hospital 4 days. And, on my 4th day, I was running up and down the hall. And they said, well, I don't think you're going to have any problems here. And they canceled all the therapy I was supposed to do. So, and they said, looks like you're not going to have any trouble disciplining yourselves to stay on a good diet. Because they asked me what I was eating before. They just said, keep it up. So, and they said, but they did say, we want you exercising every day, not just 3 days a week. And the other thing they said is try to get some of the stress out of your life. Now, that's where you can pray for me. I'm having a really hard time trying to lower the level of stress I experience on the job. And part of the problem is I really like my job. And that's what my doctor said, is that you guys are the worst. The ones that really like their jobs are the ones that don't even know they're under stress. And so I recognize that's where I am, and maybe that was a factor. However, other books I've read said stress cannot cause heart disease. It's not a factor. It can make it more difficult to manage the heart disease, but it's not a factor. So, but I am needing to take a little more time off than I do. I do recognize I work a little too hard. And you can pray for my wife. I think she's more of a workaholic than I am. So you can pray for both of us. And, in closing, I want to encourage us to be in prayer for Ross and Mary. I appreciate you sharing what you did. And, they're newlyweds. And as you point out, conflict is part of marriage. And if it wasn't, marriage would sure be boring. People often ask me, they say, well, do you and Kathy ever have any conflict? And I said, yeah, we have conflict. I said, we're never bored. because I have never had a day with... I've been married to her now for, it'll be 30 years this July. We've never had a single day where we've been bored with one another. It hasn't happened. But she's more fascinating to me now than she was 30 years ago. And she would say the same thing. But part of it is that we've learned how to deal with disagreements and conflict. And because she's so different from me, you are going to get conflict. But the whole point is, because of those differences, you can get real balance. And to me, the worst thing that can happen to a marriage is when you get bored. And when I see marriages split up, that's usually what does it. They get bored with one another, or they get tired of one another. And so that's not the case for Mary and Ross. They got other issues they need to deal with, but they need our prayers. So...